Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Pete Hamill is a veteran New York journalist and novelist. He's the author of numerous books, including Downtown, My Manhattan, and his memoir, A Drinking Life. His nine novels include Snow in August, Forever, and Tabloid City. His new book is The Christmas Kid and Other Brooklyn Stories, a collection of Brooklyn-based tales spanning 30 years. Never before together in one volume and featuring a previously unpublished story, Up the Roof, these are Hamill's tales about Brooklyn, the borough in which he was raised and born, and the one closest to his heart. The New York Daily News first published many of the pieces in this collection on Sundays in the 1980s. Yes, fiction in a newspaper. It's a pleasure to welcome Pete Hamill to the book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
When I talk about fiction in a newspaper, most of these stories came out of the 1980s and came out of an idea of writing fictional tales. And now that seems unheard of.
Now it's unheard of. But at one point in the history of American and other newspapers, plenty of people wrote for clearly identified fiction for newspapers. The most famous in our country was O. Henry. Although Stephen Crane had written some short stories for newspapers, too. But in other countries, Alberto Moravia in Italy wrote a lot of his short stories for newspapers. Kafu Nagai in Japan. There were lots of great writers who did this. And it was because, I think, editors felt there were stories out there, particularly in a city, that didn't ever hope to get on page one. They're not that kind of story. But they illuminate people, life in the city. They illuminate the people you sit next to in the subway or the bus. They make you, in some ways, I hope, a little bit more human and more able to recognize the humanity in other people. In a city as rushed and hurried as this one was, in almost all American cities.
The collection brings together the stories, and the one theme, the one commonality is Brooklyn. It is where you were born. It's where you grew up. And that's not to say that every story that you wrote and that was part of this series was about Brooklyn, but those have been brought together.
Right.
What do you think it is about Brooklyn that makes that marketable now, our interest in the place?
Well, Brooklyn is hot now. I can't afford to live there. There's many writers living there, Jonathan Safran Foer and Martin Amis and others are living there now where there were hardly any when I was a kid. It attracts writers, and it is now attracting not simply writers, but all kinds of young people who like the human scale of the architecture, the ability to see the sky, which is almost impossible in Manhattan. And I think that is churning up different energies in the borough right now. And I kept coming across people who had just moved in the previous two or three or four years to Brooklyn, who wanted to know what it was like when I was young. And so in certain ways, this book is a way of explaining, the fancy word would be the palimpsest, you know, what lies beneath the surface of those streets you're walking down right this very minute.
The cover of the book has a kid and a sled, and it is a very nostalgic photo of New York. You say on the first page about these stories that many of these stories are charged by the city's most enduring emotion, nostalgia.
Yeah.
What is it about that nostalgia that is so ripe for us, do you think?
I think, and I always try to make the distinction between nostalgia and sentimentality, because nostalgia is based on missing and aching sometimes or grieving for something that was once here and is now gone. That could be people. It could be a baseball team. It could be your favorite coffee shop that was there when you went off for the summer, and when you came back, it's another sneaker store. The rapidity of change in a place like New York is one reason for it. But also, it's an immigrant town, and everybody, whether it's the Mexicans arriving in the last 20, 25 years, the Chinese who have arrived again in large numbers for the first time in many years, are no different from the Irish, the Italian, and the Eastern European Jews. They might have hated the place that forced them into exile for various reasons, for bigotry, for the deck being stacked against them, for hunger. But it was also where they were once 5 years old, running barefoot in the grass. And so you hear immigrant music in certain neighborhoods, and it's not very different from the immigrant music that I heard as a son of Irish immigrants more than 70 years ago. So I think the combination of the immigrants and rapidity of change makes nostalgia very common.
The old saying, you can't judge a book by its cover, as I mentioned, the cover is very cozy. But when you read the stories, there is even a hint of sentimentality. However, there's also murder and there's drugs and they're the really very strong forces of life within those pages.
That are also forces for change in the way things began to change. The arrival of heroin in the 50s changed the neighborhood where I grew up. Nobody ever locked the doors in that neighborhood. Who the hell would rob anything from us? What was worth robbing? But once heroin came, the locks went on the doors. The world before television is in some of the stories. You would walk around the neighborhood like that, and someone would say, you see this guy coming down the block? He says, he's a real character. So they had a sense that there were characters in this ongoing narrative called the neighborhood, and there were. They were gold for a kid who ended up becoming a writer, as important as reading Treasure Island or The Count of Monte Cristo when you were 12. So there were the lively, because it was before television, people spent much more time in the street, for example. In the summertime, they'd sit around and gossip and tell jokes and make remarks and do all that. Later on, when the blue glow suddenly appeared in the windows of houses and people stayed home to watch Milton Berle or something, that began to change too.
Do we still, do you think, have these strong characters? Or do we still have them and we just don't notice them as much?
Well, I don't notice them, but what I hope is that the younger writers and people are paying attention. You know, that you just try to sort out who walks by in the morning in your neighborhood, who is a regular, why does he wear an overcoat in August? Why? What does he do this? Who is he? What's his story? And find ways just to be polite in the morning and say good morning. It might lead you to an 18-page story, who knows. But I hope they're happening. I sense that they are. To say that my generation was unique in the amount of stories that came out of human beings rather than books would be arrogant. I think there's stories there, and we don't know them yet. We're beginning to see them in the works of Junot Diaz and people like that, Esmeralda Santiago and others. Giving us the Latinos at last. But there's a lot more that we haven't heard yet. I hope I live long enough to hear them.
The name of the book is The Christmas Kid and Other Brooklyn Stories. Pete Hamill is our guest on this week's book show. Tell us about the Christmas Kid and how much of that story came from.
It came from something that did happen, which was a young kid who spoke very little English, arrived around 1947 or 8 in the neighborhood to stay with an uncle. And he was what was then called the DP, a displaced person, someone from Europe after the war who had lost his own family and yet had relatives somewhere in the United States who were contacted by various agencies, UNRWA and others, and tried to get the kid to come here and stay with somebody. And that he came into a neighborhood that was primarily Irish, Italian, and Eastern European Jewish. And he was a stranger afloat, and most of the kids tried to explain to him where he was. This is stickball. You see this pink ball? This is called a Spalding. Spalding, he would say. Until the summer that somebody noticed the tattoo on his arm. And I remember talking to my mother about it, because I knew about the Holocaust from seeing the films right at the end of the war, when all the newsreels began to come in from Buchenwald and other places, and the horror of it. And she explained what the tattoo probably meant, that he had been in a camp someplace, and that it was our duty to take care of him, make sure nothing happened to him. And I think some of the other parents said the same things. My mother, having been a Catholic from Belfast, knew the dangers that could come from being the other. She carried that in her DNA. But she, I think, was a true Christian in a certain way, to say it's your duty to help somebody who might need your help. And from that came the story, when I was remembering certain parts of it, I'm wondering whatever happened to him, because he was with us for like a year, a little more, and then we didn't see him, and then we heard he was in Florida or someplace. Short stories are obviously the acts of the imagination. They're not straight reporting, although you can use reporting to make them believable. So I don't think Meyer Lansky showed up dressed as one of the three wise men or the three wise guys to help free the kid out of the immigration cells downtown Brooklyn. But I sort of wanted that to happen at Christmas. And so it's essentially a Christmas tale that's about a Jewish kid.
It fascinated me, because the one thing I found interesting is you and many of your friends were going to the Catholic school. He was going to the public school. And that concern for him when he was going to the public school and sort of out of your eye.
Yeah, that's true. He was there, you know. And the public school is still there, the one I was talking about in the story. It had an amazing mixture of people in it. I didn't know them as well as I knew everybody in the Catholic school. But you wondered, it was like over the edge, over the border. Is he okay? Is he going to be all right? You know, that kind of feeling was there. So it was, that part of it is all true from experience that happened. But then you take, when you're writing fiction, it's the imagination that you're calling on.
Talk a little bit about the mix of that imagination and what I think, back to you, to use one of your terms, of in the DNA of a journalist, and using that reporting as a catalyst and an understanding of what is happening that led you to ultimately be a fiction writer.
Well, the second part of the question is in one word, frustration. You would hear wonderful stories about somebody. You couldn't quite prove them in any way. They're not worth the attention of the first five pages of the paper. Nobody gets indicted if you fall in love with the wrong girl. someone might write a blues about it, but it's not something that you say, stop the press, I got a story of a guy whose heart is broken. But the fact that the emotions were so sometimes life-altering is something that I was always amazed at. That whole Robert Frost notion of the path not taken, you know, somebody, instead of making a left, took a right somewhere and life changed. Those were the things that I was always drawn to, because I'd seen it happen with my friends, guys that were smarter than I was or had talent. The kid who was a poet, who had the poetry beaten out of him by his father, because men didn't do poetry. Those are based on real stories.
And yet there is that, I assume there was that point for you where you realized that telling stories, and ultimately for most of your career, telling stories about this city became your beat and what you knew what you wanted, that you wanted to do.
Yeah, mainly because I had lived other places. I lived in Mexico for a year. I lived in Rome for half a year. I lived in Barcelona. I lived in Dublin. But I always lived there in a way as a New Yorker. I was measuring the bus system against the New York bus system, and but also the way people behaved and moved and treated each other and the problems they confronted. So I always came home, but I came home enriched by the thing you always are enriched by when you travel, the sense of the other. And New York is one of those towns, I always think of it as the capital of people who are not like you, from whom, thank God, we get many gifts. You know, for example, I always believed that Our family, both parents are Irish, became Americans when Mrs. Caputo came across the hall in a fit of compassion and pity and taught my mother how to make the sauce. That made us part Sicilian, which meant we were much more part of a place like New York than we would have been if we had stayed in Belfast.
Growing up, did you feel like an outsider, or did you always feel like a New Yorker?
No, I always felt that I always felt like a Brooklynite because of the Dodgers, and I got baseball in just by being around. My father had to learn baseball. He was a soccer player who had lost a leg playing soccer here in the immigrant leagues. So he was slow getting to baseball. But a lot of people in New York, although the city's connected by the by subways and other things, and by sports affiliations, a lot of them don't know the whole city. I was lucky later as a reporter where I had to cover murders in all five boroughs. And I can tell you that when I was in my teens wandering around, I can't tell you how many romances ended with the following sentence. You live in the Bronx? It was like foreign country, you know, it was Yankeeville, you know, living, thinking about going there. It was an act of betrayal in some way.
Literally like that Steinberg New Yorker.
Yeah, yeah, very much like that. I'm sure the map from the Bronx's point of view would be more or less the same. I mean, a mixed marriage in my neighborhood was a Dodger fan and a Yankee fan. That was basically what it was. But I don't know if those passions are as vivid as they used to be, because baseball's more a television show than something that people do as much as they used to do. Kids don't play it as much. You see kids playing soccer in the different fields around the city, but you don't see baseball being played by kids very much. The prices are too high to take them to the games, and the games last too long. But there was something built into you in the company of everybody. On our newsstand, you had the basic newspapers, plus the Irish Echo, plus the Jewish Daily Forward, all on the same newsstand. And that was more or less the way the neighborhood organized itself.
There is a story toward the end of the book called The Book Signing, and I'm hoping you can share a little bit of what the story is about and how much of it you feel is your story.
It's a story about a successful novelist who comes back for a reading in a new Barnes & Noble that has opened not far from where he grew up. He hasn't been home in many years. He comes early before the book signing to go look at the building where he lived and remembers the girl that he was involved with all those years ago. And then he went off to the service and lost track of her and lost track of his talent. He was writing these big commercial novels about industries and airline companies and all that. He didn't care as much as he did when he was a kid about the writing part of it, and goes to the book signing, and then the girl shows up. And what happens after that is probably the fear of all writers who do public book signings. You never know who might show up. But that, again, is part of the theme of a lot of it. The past, as Faulkner said, is never past. It's still there. It's part of all human experience. Every present, we live in the present, but we carry a past around with us, too, and a vision of the future in a lot of cases. But the sense of the power of the past is in some of those stories.
Are you working on a novel?
I am, yeah.
Are you always at some stages working on a novel?
Yeah, basically. Particularly now where I don't do much journalism at all. Doing both at the same time for years was a discipline. But I managed to get a lot of it done, particularly after I stopped drinking. Where I gathered all this time. The time spent drinking and the time spent recovering allowed me to write 22 books. It'll be 40 years January 1st since I had a drink, but that helped. And it wasn't over moral reasons or anything or some sense of redemption. It was about how do I want to live and how can I do it and what my talent is. What's the size of it? You don't know until you try it. You can't ever know whether you can write a novel or 10 novels until you actually sit down and do it. And I love doing it.
Your memoir, Drinking Life, tells that story. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
When you look at the focusing mostly on the novel writing, is there a part of you that misses the journalism, or is there enough journalism within what you're writing?
Sure. You know, somebody asked me the other day, do I miss it, miss newspapers? I said only once or twice a day. You know, there some story is breaking and I want to head for the scene of the crime or the triumph. But it's something I realize that the young have better legs than I have now. God bless them. Onward. I hope they have as much fun as we had.
Pete Hamill's new book is The Christmas Kid and Other Brooklyn Stories. It is published by Little Brown. Pete Hamill, a great pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. This edition was recorded at Argo Studios in New York City. Our thanks to them. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.